Now, if somebody has fought for 40 years to carry into effect what he calls an idea, and if these alleged efforts not only show no positive results, but have not even been able to hinder the success of the opposing party, then the story of those 40 years of futile effort furnishes sufficient proof of the incompetence of such a protagonist. People of that kind are specially dangerous because they do not want to participate in the movement as ordinary members. They talk rather of the leading positions which would be the only fitting posts for them, in view of their past work, and also so that they might be enabled to carry on that work further. But woe to a young movement if the conduct of it should fall into the hands of such people. A businessman who has been in charge of a great firm for 40 years and who has completely ruined it through his mismanagement is not the kind of person one would recommend for the founding of a new firm. And it is just the same with a new national movement. Nobody of common sense would appoint to a leading post in such a movement some Teutonic Methuselah who had been ineffectively preaching some idea for a period of 40 years until himself and his idea had entered the stage of senile decay. Furthermore, only a very small percentage of such people join a new movement with the intention of serving its end unselfishly and helping in the spread of its principles. In most cases, they come because they think that, under the aegis of the new movement, it will be possible for them to promulgate their old ideas to the misfortune of their new listeners. Anyhow, nobody ever seems able to describe what exactly these ideas are. It is typical of such persons that they rant about ancient Teutonic heroes of the dim and distant ages, stone axes, battle spears, and shields, whereas in reality they themselves are the woefulest poltroons imaginable. For those very same people who brandish Teutonic tin swords that have been fashioned carefully according to ancient models, and wear padded bearskins with the horns of oxen mounted over their bearded faces, proclaim that all contemporary conflicts must be decided by the weapons of the mind alone, and thus they skedaddle when the first communist cudgel appears. Posterity will have little occasion to write a new epic on these heroic gladiators. I have seen too much of that kind of people not to feel a profound contempt for their miserable play-acting. To the masses of the nation, they are just an object of ridicule. But the Jew finds it to his own interest to treat these folklore comedians with respect, and to prefer them to real men who are fighting to establish a German state. And yet, these comedians are extremely proud of themselves. Notwithstanding their complete fecklessness, which is an established fact, they pretend to know everything better than other people, so much so that they make themselves a veritable nuisance to all sincere and honest patriots, to whom not only the heroism of the past is worthy of honour, but who also feel bound to leave examples of their own work for the inspiration of the coming generation. Among those people, there were some whose conduct can be explained by their innate stupidity and incompetence. But there are others who have a definite ulterior purpose in view. Often it is difficult to distinguish between the two classes. The impression which I often get, especially of those so-called religious reformers, whose creed is grounded on ancient Germanic customs, is that they are the missionaries and protégés of those forces which do not wish to see a national revival taking place in Germany. All their activities tend to turn the attention of the people away from the necessity of fighting together in a common cause against the common enemy, namely the Jew. Moreover, that kind of preaching induces the people to use up their energies not in fighting for the common cause, but in absurd and ruinous religious controversies within their own ranks. There are definite grounds that make it absolutely necessary for the movement to be dominated by a strong central force, which is embodied in the authoritative leadership. In this way alone, it is possible to counteract the activity of such fatal elements. And that is just the reason why these folklore Ahasueruses are vigorously hostile to any movement whose members are firmly united under one leader and one discipline. Those people of whom I have spoken hate such a movement because it is capable of putting a stop to their mischief. It was not without good reason that when we laid down a clearly defined program for the new movement, we excluded the word Völkisch from it. The concept underlying the term Völkisch cannot serve as the basis of a movement because it is too indefinite and general in its application. Therefore, if somebody called himself Völkisch, such a designation could not be taken as the hallmark of some definite party affiliation. Because the concept is so indefinite from the practical viewpoint, it gives rise to various interpretations, and thus people can appeal to it all the more easily as a sort of personal recommendation. Whenever such a vague concept, which is subject to so many interpretations, is admitted into a political movement, it tends to break up the disciplined solidarity of the fighting forces. No such solidarity can be maintained if each individual member be allowed to define for himself what he believes and what he is willing to do. One feels it a disgrace when one notices the kind of people who float about nowadays with the Völkisch symbol stuck in their buttonholes, and at the same time to notice how many people have various ideas of their own as to the significance of that symbol. A well-known professor in Bavaria, a famous combatant who fights only with the weapons of the mind, and who boasts of having marched against Berlin by shouldering the weapons of the mind, of course, believes that the word Völkisch is synonymous with monarchical, but this learned authority has hitherto neglected to explain how our German monarchs of the past can be identified with what we generally mean by the term Völkisch today. I'm afraid he will find himself at a loss if he is asked to give a precise answer. For it would be very difficult indeed to imagine anything less Völkisch than most of those German monarchical states were. Had they been otherwise, they would not have disappeared. Or if they were Völkisch, then the fact of their downfall may be taken as evidence that the Völkisch outlook on the world, Weltanschauung, is a false outlook. Everybody interprets this concept in his own way, but such multifarious opinions cannot be adopted as the basis of a militant political movement. I need not call attention to the absolute lack of worldly wisdom, and especially the failure to understand the soul of the nation, which is displayed by these messianic precursors of the 20th century. Sufficient attention has been called to those people by the ridicule which the left-wing parties have bestowed on them. They allow them to babble on and sneer at them. I do not set much value on the friendship of people who do not succeed in getting disliked by their enemies. Therefore, we considered the friendship of such people as not only worthless, but even dangerous to our young movement. That was the principal reason why we first called ourselves a party. We hoped that by giving ourselves such a name, we might scare away a whole host of Turkish dreamers. And that was the reason also why we named our party the National Socialist German Labour Party. The first term, party, kept away all those dreamers who live in the past, and all the lovers of bombastic nomenclature, as well as those who went around beating the big drum for the folkish idea. The full name of the party kept away all those heroes whose weapon is the sword of the spirit, and all those whining poltroons who take refuge behind their so-called intelligence, as if it were a kind of shield. It was only to be expected that this latter class would launch a massed attack against us after our movement had started. But, of course, it was only a pen and ink attack, for the goose quill is the only weapon which these folkish lancers wield. We had declared one of our principles thus: we shall meet violence with violence in our own defense. Naturally, that principle disturbed the equanimity of the Knights of the Pen. They reproached us bitterly, not only for what they called our crude worship of the cudgel, but also because, according to them, we had no intellectual forces on our side. These charlatans did not think for a moment that a Demosthenes could be reduced to silence at a mass meeting by 50 idiots who had come there to shout him down and use their fists against his supporters. The innate cowardice of the pen and ink charlatan prevents him from exposing himself to such a danger, for he always works in safe retirement and never dares to make a noise or come forward in public. Even today, I must warn the members of our young movement in the strongest possible terms to guard against the danger of falling into the snare of those who call themselves silent workers. These silent workers are not only a white-livered lot, but are also, and always will be, ignorant do-nothings. A man who is aware of certain happenings and knows that a certain danger threatens, and at the same time sees a certain remedy which can be employed against it, is in duty bound not to work in silence, but to come out into the open and publicly fight for the destruction of the evil and the acceptance of his own remedy. If he does not do so, then he is neglecting his duty, and shows that he is weak in character, and that he fails to act either because of his timidity, or indolence, or incompetence. Most of these silent workers generally pretend to know God knows what. Not one of them is capable of any real achievement, but they keep on trying to fool the world with their antics. Though quite indolent, they try to create the impression that their silent work keeps them very busy. To put it briefly, they are sheer swindlers, political jobbers, who feel chagrined by the honest work which others are doing. When you find one of these folkish moths buzzing over the value of his silent work, you may be sure that you are dealing with a fellow who does no productive work at all, but steals from others the fruits of their honest labor. In addition to all this, one ought to note the arrogance and conceited impudence with which these obscurantist idlers try to tear to pieces the work of other people, criticizing it with an air of superiority, and thus playing into the hands of the mortal enemy of our people. Even the simplest follower, who has the courage to stand on the table in some beer hall where his enemies are gathered, and manfully and openly defend his position against them, achieves a thousand times more than these thinking hypocrites. He at least will convert one or two people to believe in the movement. One can examine his work and test its effectiveness by its actual results, but those knavish swindlers who praise their own silent work and shelter themselves under the cloak of anonymity are just worthless drones in the truest sense of the term, and are utterly useless for the purpose of our national reconstruction.